The great thing about doing these Dharma talks, especially after hearing that before lecture chant, is I'm reminded that while I am speaking, often the lessons or the words that I'm offering come to us from other teachers, other places, or just by the greater sort of dharmic presence that's here. So with that energy, I offer you this talk about tea as medicine. So as part of this tonight, I'm going to offer you a kind of longish poem by Miho Kinas, and also a small teaching by Thich Nhat Hanh, and then an audio, a 5-minute audio about tea as medicine. I entitled the talk Tea as Medicine, and some of you who attended the Tuesday Dharma Tea this past week will have heard bits of this, parts of this. And so you already know that it's not so much about the, for example, the antioxidant benefits of drinking tea itself, or the herbal qualities that it might have on your body. It's not about the science of the components of tea. So I'm going to start with a poem, and how I came to learn about this poem is that I was listening to a program on WPFW, which is a local radio station here in Washington, D.C. And on Wednesdays in the mid-morning, there is a highly awarded writer, poet named E. Ethelbert Miller, and he interviews other authors and poets on this show, which is called On the Margin. So I was fortunate to have the time to listen to it. And he was interviewing recently the poet Miho Kinas, who I didn't know anything about. And she read the poem that I'm going to read for you today on the interview. She is originally from Japan, but she has made the United States her longtime home. And I think she might live down near Hilton Head or somewhere in the lower southeast, near the water. She does work as a translator and a writer herself. And just as an aside, E. Ethelbert Miller will actually be coming to our tea next Tuesday. And he'll be leading us in a conversation that that he had with the pretty renowned Buddhist and author Charles Johnson. So I hope that you can make time to join us next Tuesday when E. Ethelbert Miller is actually our special guest for our Dharma Tea. But here is Miho's poem. Small purple flowers, not the bush clover from home. The poem is called High Marsh. Fishermen cast nets in the low marsh and families picnic on the beach. I didn't expect to see anyone on the high marsh. In a wax myrtle tree, a man was sitting in his hammock. I nodded and he nodded back. Staying in a tree may not be a bad idea on such a windy day. I unfolded my chair in the open and waited for the clapper calls. In the salt marsh, clapper rails keep distance from each other like a constellation. A few yards behind me, completely ignoring my presence, the last bird cawed. Beyond the marsh and the sandbars, the sea was full of whitecaps. This time of year, piping plovers rest behind the "Don't Disturb the Birds" sign. I came here to do nothing. I brought a pair of binoculars for disguise. I crossed my leg over my knee to pull the spiky seeds off my shoe. The next dry wind unraveled the sweetgrass and frayed jeans. In the last city I lived, there were people who just sat around, not sunbathing, not reading or waiting, not even relaxing, just being. Climbing out of his hammock, the man made sure that I'd hear his approach. In his faded t-shirt and cargo pants, he walked toward the fell tree where I had stood earlier. It was now half in water as the tide was coming in. He turned around, raised his right hand a little, and went back to his hammock. A bird shadow crossed over my face. Then the snowy egret continued on chasing mackerel clouds. I got up and folded the chair. On the sandy turf, I found my favorite bush plant with small purple flowers. When I looked back, the hammock was gone. So the poet and I had a little correspondence this past week. And I was delighted that she stated in that correspondence, this is Miho saying, "My family belongs to a Soto temple in Shizuoka, Japan." So I just thought it was so sweet that she would state that, you know, that, and also this aspect of like very strongly and clearly knowing that her family belonged to the Soto temple. It made me wonder about how I consider what I belong to. And I wonder, what do you consider? What do you belong to? I also found in the middle of the poem that I read for you, the kind of delightful acknowledgement that she makes that she brought the binoculars as disguise so she could do nothing. So I'm going to now segue a little bit and say that I think most of you know that the Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh passed into Parinirvana recently in January 22nd. His gentle voice and loving teachings remain beautiful bites of wisdom to recall. One that I thought was very useful in these times, he actually offered, if you remember, he had offered it in 2013 when he was traveling around to many, many places, institutions, businesses. And in this particular case, he was at Google in California. And so he said, "We have the feeling that we are overwhelmed by information. We don't need that much information. Do not try to find the solution with your thinking mind. Non-thinking is the success. Sorry, non-thinking is the secret of success. And that is why the time when we are not working, that time can be very productive if we know how to focus on the moment. Non-thinking is the secret of success. And that is why the time we are not working, that time can be very productive if we know how to focus on the moment." So I think my experience of Zen practice and Zen forms kind of create these spaces for us to stay in one place and go deep, to focus on the moment. So I had the opportunity, the invitation recently to talk to some people who are at the Freer Museum, Smithsonian. They are preparing to open an exhibit which features art and objects from Buddhist monks in medieval Japan. And I was asked to offer my thoughts on five pieces that will be in that museum show, which runs from February 26th to July 24th this year. So I'm going to play you a 5-minute audio from a conversation that I had with them about one of those objects. And the object was a T-ball, not terribly unlike this one. This is made in a traditional fashion, much like in Japan. This is made by an American, actually, who lives in Northern Virginia. His name is Bill Toge Kruban, and he is a Rinzai Zen practitioner who made this and gave it to me recently. So the piece in the show is about the same size, I think, but maybe has some different coloration. So that's, and I just wanted to have an idea of what they were asking me to look at, because I don't actually have it to show you. And let me transition now to seeing if I can make this audio work for us to listen to for a few moments.
Zen priest Reverend Inryu Bavi Ponsa Barger of All Beings Zen Sangha in Washington, D.C. speaks about how this 16th century tea bowl like this might have been used by Zen monks.
From a practitioner's standpoint, you know, when you're in monastery, everything has what we call forms or rules about how things are handled, from your garments that you're wearing to how you're holding your chopsticks as you eat, to how you're holding the tea bowl. And so very often the form would be that there would be tea served in the afternoons. Anything that's served after the midday meal is considered medicine in the monastery. They don't call it nutrition or food if it's after lunch. So in this case, the tea, and really it is, because you're working long hours. You've been up since 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. It's the afternoon and all your energy is flagging. And so you're called back into the temple, the Zendo, and you sit at your cushion and your tea bowl is in front of you, and the attendants, the people that are serving the tea, come around and you hold the tea in a very prescribed way with one hand under the tea bowl, left hand, and the right hand to hold the side. And you just indicate very subtly when you've had enough tea poured. You know, there's a prescribed way of bringing it to your lips and kind of setting it down. So this particular tea bowl, as I looked at it, one of the things I really liked is that the bottom of it doesn't have any glaze, which means tactile. It would be lovely to hold. It would feel more secure. I would feel more secure with it in my hand because the person who's created it has left that kind of rough edge on it to it. And then there's also the swirling in the bottom, which, you know, kind of the fingering of the potter. So it kind of lets you see the potter's fingers, but also it lets your fingers kind of pull the object with better dexterity. So having said that, just the colors of the glazes, you know, these wonderful earth and almost mountainy kind of glazes were just really beautiful. So when you're being served the tea and everybody's drinking tea silently, in fact, the idea is that the whole thing happens silently, the pouring, the cleaning, the putting away, everything silent. You're really taking your time to bring the tea forward. So you're really feeling, admiring the weight of the bowl, the fragrance, the aroma. It's often there is no heating in a Zendo, so it might be the steam even, that you're just enjoying the warmth of the hot steam coming into your face. Obviously, the warmth into the body, and then also that aspect of nourishment, that medicinal quality of taking something hot and lovely into the body when you need it. Often it's served with a little sweet, and so that also would be a kind of extra medicinal support for you as an individual monk to get through the rest of your day. So the repair, the kintsugi repair that's been done, back then would have used varnish or resin with gold dust in the joinery. And what would that do to somebody using it? Well, I think what it would call forward very much is the lessons that we have around impermanence and the fact that it is the nature of all things to change. And so in a very kind of a beautiful way, we bring forward a very grave lesson of Zen, which is this kind of tender-hearted intimacy that we develop and some practice with everything, with our cushions, the teacup, with our chopsticks, with the bird outside the Zendo. There is this intimacy created when we let other things sort of drop away And so here you have this teacup that's been repaired, which is kind of showing us that tenderness, that vulnerability, that impermanent quality to all things. So in some ways, the teacup itself is that lesson about impermanence. And the precious, and the flip side of that then is it awakens for us or amplifies the preciousness of our life, right? If something so precious can be broken, our own lives can also be gone in a moment. And so we can have a greater awareness and appreciation for and care for what we do have. And so, you know, broken teacup, one of the Zen masters, paraphrasing because I couldn't find the exact quote, but I think it's Katagiri Roshi who said, you know, you look at your teacup and the tea and you think the teacup is just a teacup. He says, I look into the teacup and I see the universe. So this aspect that like everything is right there, the dynamic creation of it, the repair of it, the use of it for how many decades, years, the lips that have touched the rim, the water that has come to be poured into it and its origin, the water's origin. Just, you know, so many things can indeed, if you allow yourself to go to that kind of depth of engagement with it, allow us to kind of see this primary lesson of Zen is about that we're creating this moment, we're co-creating this moment. So I'm not alone making this moment of drinking this beautiful tea out of this mug, but there's all these vast things that are happening simultaneously to allow this moment to be present. So this co-creation kind of comes forward, I think, in seeing this particular Kitsugi bowl.
So Zen practice is not for the faint of heart. To stay still and really drink tea is a heroine's path, the hero's path. Great is the matter before us. The journey may take us to far off lands, or the journey may take us to drop deep into the awakening connection to all things. Birth, life, and death. We can be like Miho and take to the marsh to do nothing. We can hear Thich Nhat Hanh's call to halt our grasping for more information. We can look into the tea bowl like Katagiri and see the universe. Our friends along the way, Katagiri, Miho, and Thich Nhat Hanh, say something to us. What do they say? I'll begin to tie this talk up with a little lesson from the wonderful scholar, Joseph Campbell. He says, the heroine's journey, the hero's journey, always begins with the call. One way or another, a guide must come to say, look, you're in sleepy land. Wake, come on a trip. There is this whole aspect of your consciousness, your being, that's not being touched. So you're at home here? Well, there's not enough of you there. And so it starts. So may we together enjoy the medicine of taking tea, doing nothing, letting our grasping, letting go of our grasping, and taking the trip, the journey of going deep. Moment by moment, starting again and again, sip by sip. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Thank you for listening.